hppodcraft.com.
When Barrett finally regained consciousness, he saw that the lights were bright again. D'Artois, kneeling at his side, was sponging his wounds. "All in the approach," a calm, deep voice was saying. "Your friend, though God alone knows how, withstood the beast by pure force of will to slay. But that was misguided effort." Barrett, with a sudden effort, propped himself up on his elbow to confront the person who so lightly disposed of that nightmare battle with that monster from an unknown hell. But his strength was unequal to his curiosity, and he sank back to the floor.
Welcome back as we jump back into the creepy subterranean terror of the Devil's Crypt by E. Hoffman Price.
It's a nightmare battle that we're going to lightly dispose of today here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com, broadcasting on Patreon just for you.
And that reader was Mr. Andrew Lehman of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Andrew and Sean Branny recently discussed some letters between E. Hoffman Price and Lovecraft on their podcast, Voluminous. We'll link out to that episode in the show notes. I am going to listen to those episodes actually after we record this so that I can experience the sensation of why didn't these idiots listen to Voluminous first along with our subscribers.
Oh, boy.
Really should have done that.
Yeah. You know what else you should listen to?
What's that?
Dark Adventure Radio Theater's production of The Horror in the Museum.
Yes.
It's out now, 77 minutes of joy and mystery. As usual, there are a bunch of amazing props. If you get the physical package, we'll link out to it. You must grab it now.
Now that I got yesterday, but we were about to record, so I didn't have the 77 minutes for that joy and mystery, but I have that available to me as well, and I'm going to be listening soon, but I can tell you it's probably going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Because all of those have been great. If you've collected some of them, you should get all of them.
Quick recap. At the party of Don Jose, there are these twin sisters, Louise and Yvonne. Louise went out for a walk and was killed by a demon. Our protagonist, Pierre Dutoit, old French guy, and Davis Barrett, young American, went out to look for her and found her body. Dutoit is an occult scholar, and Davis is a young tough dude?
I don't know. We found out he knows a lot of wrestling moves. He knows holds taught by Japanese masters.
Yeah.
And we also found out he has very little confidence in his own convictions, which actually in the world of this story is very good. He gets led along by astrologers, and it turns out that's the right choice for once.
Yeah. Dutoit uses astrology to figure out something is up and that Louise's sister, Yvonne, is going to get it next. He also deduces that Don Jose is the evil wizard who is going to do the killing. Dutoit knows that he can't handle Don Jose alone, so he leaves to go find the occultist Sadi Abdurrahman to help take down Don Jose, and Davis Barrett hangs back to protect Yvonne. A demon shows up to kill Yvonne, and Davis frickin' goes into a blind fury, fights the demon. Of course, the demon kicks his ass, and he passes out. That gets us to what we read at the top. Now, when Barrett comes to, Dutoit is there with Sadi. Sadi has a freshness in his bronze skin, even though he seems ancient. Like a solemn Assyrian colossus had come to life, he has a neatly trimmed and square-cut beard.
I thought maybe the monster had won that fight. It seemed like that from where we left off.
Yeah.
And these guys maybe showed up just at the right time to save Barrett. But from the way this chapter goes on, it seems like he just passed out. It says he withstood the beast by pure force of will to slay, which is awesome. So I guess he was just too much trouble. Once he passed out, the monster went, all right, I'm going to move on, abduct Yvonne, and get out of here.
Yeah.
But I felt like that was such a missed opportunity to give me some sense of what these astrologers can do other than draw circles.
Yeah. There's a lot of missed opportunities in this story. I do have to say that things like he withstood the beast by pure force of will to slay. There's a bunch of lines like that in this that are awesome.
Yeah, they sure are.
Unfortunately, there's lots of bits that are also kind of confusing and hard to figure out what is exactly happening in the story. I don't know if you came across that. I think we mentioned that last episode.
I got confused here and there. A little bit of it, though, is kind of fun because it's kind of like when a kid tells you a story and you try to figure out what the logic of it is. They introduce things late, you know. No. Well, I didn't tell you Superman's in this. What? You know, so things like that happen.
Yeah. Now, Yvonne is gone, but where? They don't know. Dutoit intends to find out. He tells them to clear the floor. Sadi draws a circle on the floor and divides it into seven sectors. He explains they have to find the master of this demon because finding the demon itself straight on won't work.
Got to get to the source of the evil. I understand that these guys have some kind of secret knowledge, but I always kept wondering why Barrett was hanging out with them. And in this moment, he was sponging his wounds as he came to, but once he comes to, they just don't care about him anymore. They're like, let's move on. Get out of the way. We got to draw a circle. And also, this new guy, City, is kind of a jerk. He says, well, he won that fight, but it was a misguided effort. The monster attacked him and he was defending a woman. So I don't know if misguided effort is the best way to describe that.
Yeah.
If the demon was like in a pub bathroom and he just jumped him and beat his ass, then I'd go, yeah, criticize him. He initiated that. But this is a little like if I fended off a mugger and somebody was like, well, you know, that does nothing to solve the problem of crime. Yeah, but my throat is still here, which is exactly like, you know, so far, all these guys have done is really draw circles and then they're mean to Barrett on top of it.
I think he's saying it was a misguided effort to try and fight that thing because there was no way you're going to win. You know, if Thanos is going to come take your wife away from you, and you just go try and punch him. It's kind of a misguided effort. It's not going
to
work.
Yeah, but I need my wife to see that I tried. Let's be real. Try and explain what you just explained to me to my wife later.
Oh, well.
You couldn't have even punched him? Nah, it just wouldn't have been worth it. He was clearly taking you.
The Hulk punches that guy and he's all right. What are you going to do?
What am I going to do?
Yeah, against Thanos. Nothing.
I'm going to try the punch, though, because I don't want to deal with this fight we're talking about later. Anyway, this guy, City, draws an even bigger circle, and then he informs us what's up.
Seems that the great magicians were all from Atlantis. And we get some crazy world-building stuff. The Atlantean magicians created monsters and enslaved them. They became the minions of the kings of darkness. They sacrificed animals and men to keep them under their control. This went on for 50,000 years. Until the Dragons of Wisdom, we don't know who those guys were or what they were. Maybe they were literal dragons. We don't know. The Dragons of Wisdom sent Doom to kill the wizards, and Atlantis was destroyed. And that happened 850,000 years ago.
If it weren't for the 850,000 years ago, I would assume the Dragons of Wisdom are like a warrior-style street gang with cool vests and, you know, that whole thing.
Siddhi says that they must make the slave betray the master. They will use blood to bribe and drug the demon. Barrett says, doesn't sound very Muslim. And Dutoit says, who says he's Muslim? He transcends race and religion.
That was kind of cool. Yeah. Or, you know, his learning transcends race and religion. There's like something. I mean, it was a little stupid because it says his study is from occult records, which are the fountainhead of learning and transcend race and religion. And I thought, well, occult means by nature that something's esoteric. So it can't really be a fountainhead of learning and be a cult. But I thought what he was trying to say was that there's a real nature underneath things. And these religious and racial divisions are stupid because there's this core, you know, underground conflict.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe this is confirming something we maybe thought last time. And I think this got cut from the episode, other than we were happy he had written some story criticizing the KKK. But in the episode, I made a joke. You know, maybe I said, well, maybe he actually was just angry with the KKK as an organization and wasn't actually angry about what they were doing. And we laughed about that. And it didn't make the episode because it seemed kind of preposterous. Well, here's something I found on the Past and Present Futures blog from Andy Duncan, the science fiction writer.
Is this bad news?
It's bad. Bad news. The blog. Well,
no, why?
You tell me what you think. Here's the blog post title: E. Hoffman Price apologizes to the Klan.
Oh God, no. Jesus.
This is what Andy Duncan writes. Given H.P. Lovecraft's racism, is his bust an inappropriate likeness for the World Fantasy Award in the 21st century? It's an excellent question, one thoughtfully dealt with in an influential 2011 blog post by Nnedi Okorafor, the first black winner of the World Fantasy Award for Best Novel. And I'm trampolining off only one of her sentences, which was, if this is how some of the great minds of speculative fiction felt, then let's deal with that, as opposed to never mention it or explain it away.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the tack we like to take here. I mean, if it comes up, let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
Here's how the blog post continues. With these prompts in mind, I'll occasionally post to this blog stuff I've stumbled across in my archival reading that I sort of wish I hadn't read. Stuff that makes me squirm with dismay in hopes it'll help us realize both how far we've come and how far we have to go, which brings me to E. Hoffman Price.
Aww.
Price was hardly one of the great minds of speculative fiction, and he's not much read today, but he was a popular and influential pulp writer of adventure stories with exotic locales. In 1975, the excellent small press Carcosa published Farlands, Other Days, a nearly 600-page hardcover collection of Hoffman's stories. From his home in Redwood City, California, Price wrote an 11-page foreword for the collection, dated October 74, when Price was 76 years old. Toward the end of the foreword, he states his misgivings about one of the stories reprinted in the book The Infidel's Daughter, which was originally in Weird Tales, 1927. He writes, When the editor included this story, I suggested that it be rewritten so that I could correct errors of reference and terminology wherein I'd pulled several boners. And primarily, I wished to rebuild the narrative to eliminate my 1927 digs at the KKK. At the time, the organization had fallen to a self-made low and was fair game. So he really did just have problems with them as an organization.
Wow.
Which is so funny. That's the exact joke I made. The following year, I moved to New Orleans, where I lived until 1934. Ever since the civil rights idiocies and extremes, I have watched with increasing revulsion the sorry mess which Northern and Western and Eastern meddlers have made, ultimately to their regret of integration. This sociologically inspired silliness, based on unrealistic benevolence and goodwill, this disastrous idiocy leads me first to tender my apologies to the KKK. Without going whole hog as to that organization's hates, I say that since the violent and vicious criminal, regardless of color or creed, has become a menace blessed by the courts, the probation, and parole authorities, and a mass of simpleton citizens, some organization to protect harassed citizens is long overdue. Okay. 47 years ago, when I lambasted the KKK, I had no qualms about going about of an evening and quite unarmed. Today, I keep both car doors locked and have ever at hand what it takes to repel boarders. At home, my shotgun is loaded and ready. I reiterate apologies to the KKK for running off at the mouth. The editor argued against a rewrite. Perhaps that is just the thing. My whimsy of 1927 demands that I write here as I do, and in all this, I have more to say than I ever did in the story itself. So there you go.
What a douche. God.
I kind of wish I hadn't seen that, just like the author of the blog post, because it kind of took some of this, even though I was being hard on this story anyway, I did enjoy a lot of it, and then it kind of took some of the steam out of that. But
man,
again, I mean, we're always trucking in this where it's a little conflicting when you find out personal details about some of these authors.
God, it feels like all of them were assholes. Was it the period of time? Is it the type of person that wrote weird fiction? What was it about this that, or was that just America? Was that just how everybody or most people were in America when there was a few forward-thinking individuals?
It's so hard to deal with this stuff. I mean, you know, we talk about it here and there. My dad was born in 1924, and he was a racist.
Yeah.
He was just a straight up, I mean, you witnessed it. It was humiliating. Yeah. And sometimes I think I get mad at folks when they'll lobby terms like virtue signaling, or they kind of infer that as a white male, if I have attitudes about racial equality or equality among the sexes or anything like that, that is virtue signaling, i.e. it's not my own mind. I'm doing that because it's a popularity contest or something. But that's just not true. For me personally, this is something I've been dealing with my whole life from a different angle than the oppressed group. But like, it's just something that it's just something to grapple with when you love somebody and they feel that way.
Yeah.
And I think that like with a lot of this fiction, it's the same way. I love it. But these people, God. Yeah. Anyway, to your question, because I was around those attitudes from an earlier generation, I mean, my dad was younger than these guys by 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me even in the slightest. I mean, this was just stuff that was bandied around my dinner table. So this sounds exactly like that. And it kind of just gets to the core of something that deep down outrages me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. True.
So yeah. But I think it was the time period.
Yeah, I think everybody, I mean, Barack Obama wrote about his grandmother and she was racist. And that was the conflict that he had with her and that she had with him. Mm-hmm. And you know, she loved him and took care of him, but there was still, she would see black guys and cross the street to avoid them.
Yeah.
You know, it's that older generation, things have changed. And I guess you just gotta accept that that was the way things were, and hopefully things are getting better. And when we read these things, remember that they were written in this time.
But I will say that this letter in and of itself, or this foreword that Price wrote, is kind of an interesting study in weird gymnastics that somebody with these attitudes are doing in their minds, because you notice he says, well, I don't go whole hog for what the KKK believes. And then he conflates the issue with crime and sort of says, well, this is a justice organization that keeps people safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the other stuff I can overlook, even though I know it's, because he kind of says criminals of all colors and creeds, you know, he's trying to do this sort of weird switch.
Well, let's get back to the story.
Yes. And
Sadie begins the ritual, getting ready to cut his arm open to offer up the blood for the demon. But Barrett says, let me in on this. And he offers up his own arm. But Sadie says he's got some old debt that he has to pay from a past life. He spills his own blood into a bowl and he said some words. The bowl glows and a shadow appears. It's the beast from before, but it's kneeling and submissive. And it goes in and it drinks the blood out of the bowl like a lapping dog. Sadie does some magic and the creature is afraid. Dutoit gives Barrett a gun and says there will be men later.
Now, this is somehow a summoning of the soul of the beast. because these beasts are kind of like elemental souls that power these monsters. And Cydia is using some kind of ghostly material for that soul to inhabit. So it's not exactly the beast that was there before. It's some kind of spectral form of it. I imagine it kind of looked like it's got glow paint on it. I kind of imagine one of the dogs from Ghostbusters, but with glow paint on it.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Now, the demon leads them through the streets, then down some stairs into tunnels under the city. They find a dungeon. From there, there's a moat. And then they get up to a bank where the dried moat, and to a large tree, and finally to the entrance of a casemate where the demon stops. And a casemate is an old military like turret.
Yeah, when I looked it up, I was like, I bet there's some health and some ammunition in there. I just immediately went into video game mode when I saw it.
Now, Barrett asks how Don Jose was able to bring this demon into existence, and D'Artois tells him, to give a demon a body, you must give it something of your own, some of your spirit, for it to exist in our world. It's very taxing. It leads to the eventual ruin of the sorcerers that do such things. It says, the force that animates this materialization of the monster is the elemental spirit that ensouled the body of the beast that killed Louise. This, which we now see, is not its physical body, and thus being bound in an artificially created etheric form, the elemental cannot warn its master of our approach.
So there you go. That's what's going down with this thing.
Now, they get to the old tower through a newly cut entrance, low into the side. They step down into the room of incalculable antiquity. They hear drums from deeper in the tunnels. Cydia must stay at the entrance to hold the demon while D'Artois and Barnett investigate. They go down the tunnel and finally into a domed room that glows an eerie blue from floating orbs, and we get some monster cultists. Warped and gnarled, these subterranean dwellers, long-armed hairy servitors of a race that had vanished aeons before man in his present form appeared. There's a regular fancy-robed dude, a human dude at the center of all this, and of course, it is Don Jose. He's become the high priest of the subterranean beastmen, which is pretty awesome. I think that's cool. Now, Barrett has a random creepy thought about, what do these guys eat? And I thought to myself, is he implying that maybe they're ghouls? You know, they're cannibals?
Yeah, well, it's got to be something like that. They're not going up to the food court for anything. They're stuck down here, so they're eating. Or they're eating some kind of, I mean, what do you eat when you live in a cave where there's no sunlight growing plants? And yeah, maybe just mushrooms,
I guess.
The bigger revelation here was that Don Jose was the occult mastermind. That totally surprised me, because you only knew that before you even ever met Don Jose. And seeing him here, it was like, whoa, this is absolutely no surprise. It was treated like it was supposed to surprise you, but literally, he told you that before you even met the guy.
There's some curtains, some big blue curtains that part, and we find Yvonne drugged and in front of an altar. Barrett pulls his gun, but D'Artois tells him it won't be enough. They need strategy. And he says the odds are 20-1. And does that mean that they're... are 40 of these subterranean guys, or is he just throwing out Vegas odds?
I don't know. Let me draw a circle real quick and see if I can figure it out.
Then a new demon spirit starts forming into existence, and Yvonne is the fuel for this one. So Don Jose is going to use her to make a new demon body for this other demon guy. Barrett is really gun happy, and he says, let's go out in a blaze of glory. But D'Artois is like, chill, dude. We got to rescue Yvonne.
Is the whole purpose just to bring about the second demon, or is that then going to do something? What's the big goal of this? Were you ever clear on that?
I think he just wants another demon minion to do evil.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Okay, fair enough.
So Cydia is busy holding the first demon, so he can't help. Don Jose is doing the ritual. The acolytes are showing up with a bowl and a knife. It's all going to go down, and that gets us into chapter 4, The Lords of Fire. Barrett can't stand it any longer. Blam, blam, blam. He's blasting cultists. First the ones with the knife, then the ones with the bowl. D'Artois tells him to keep picking them off.
I was confused when the gunfire started, though, because the sound effect that Hoffman used was smack, smack, smack. Which isn't totally wrong. Gunfire does kind of sound like that.
It
but
does.
It's just so traditionally associated with slapping somebody. I thought some kind of Three Stooges action was going on or something.
That would
why
rad.
You? There's a demon out there. Get to shooting. Smack, smack, smack.
So the gunfire causes the cultists to panic, and Barrett tries to shoot Don Jose, but he dives for cover. The cultists regroup and attack with their knives, and he's able to blast quite a few of them, but still there's plenty of them to get through. D'Artois gives him a knife, and he says it's time to fight. Notice D'Artois isn't doing anything yet.
He's just managing, I guess.
So Barrett is such a badass that he's keeping all these beastmen cultists back with just a knife, and he tells D'Artois to go get Don Jose. And we find out that D'Artois is a master swordsman. Just dropping that right now. Okay.
Sure. I might have mentioned that before, but yeah, I was like, ooh, then I bet we're going to have an amazing sword fighting battle.
No. I thought he had a... I'm like, does he have a sword then? But I think later on they say that he has a knife. Pertois has a knife as well, so he doesn't have a sword. But I guess if you're a swordsman, then you're also good with a knife. I'm very confused. This is some of the writing.
He might have like a sword cane or something like that. But I was under the impression he had a sword, that he was going to use it, but then it just didn't... I don't know.
I also felt like he had a sword cane, but I don't think that's anywhere in the text. I think that just came
Maybe
from...
Maybe we just want him to have it, yeah.
from our imagination, yes.
If he did have it, I imagine he'd be kind of like Zorro, except instead of Z's, he'd leave circles everywhere, so you knew it was him. The astrologer strikes again.
Both of them retreat a bit for a better position, but they're still outnumbered. Don Jose casts a spell that causes fire to rise from the floor and imprison them. It is elemental fire.
Awesome. There'd be a really slowed down, like, big booming version of Ring of Fire by, you know, Johnny and June Cash playing if this was the trailer for the movie. How they do that with everything now. I fell in.
You know, our good friend Greg Johnson, he... did Lloyd's Bank is around here, and they do that with pop songs. You know, they do slow down versions of them, you know, make them sound like kind of important and sad and poignant. So he did one of Mbop. It's really funny. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Yeah. D'Artois tells Barrett to resist the flames, the idea of the flames. So this is a battle of wills. D'Artois tells Don Jose, I will defy your will, and that gives Barrett the faith that he needs as well, and he repeats D'Artois' words.
Yeah, a little Power of Christ Compels You section here. Mm-hmm. They all chant, I defy your will and power with my will and my power. Okay. Felt like it was a self-help retreat or something. but it's just people fighting each other with willpower, I guess.
Sure. The flames stop coming at them, but it's too much for Barrett, and he begins to crack, and it's over. Don Jose laughs triumphantly. Just then, a powerful voice booms in. My will against your will. My power against your power. It's Sadie. And he says, I have returned to accomplish where once I failed. You escaped me ages ago when the Dragons of Wisdom proclaimed the Black Knight of Doom for Lost Atlantis. I failed. But in many lives I have lived since then, I have gained power against your power and will against your will. So Don Jose tries to control the flame, but it now belongs to Sadie. He uses it to sweep against Don Jose and the Beastmen. There was no outcry, only hissing and cracking that endured but an instant. Then the dreadful stench of searing flesh as flame, hungrier than any earthly fire, lapped with deadly swiftness, roaring as winds lashing monstrous cliffs. Pretty brutal stuff. D'Artois and Barrett are dazed by this bright blast, but when their vision returns, they can see Sadie and his powers fading. He says that this is the end of an old feud started many lives ago, and he explains he was not ready to accept the power of the occult masters, but he had to do so in order to stop Don Jose, and it's a sacrifice that he's willing to make. D'Artois says, we can do nothing for Sadie Abdurrahman. Get Yvonne quick before we all go mad.
So he used his magic force. He sacrificed himself to stop these guys. And then D'Artois, showing his characteristic callousness towards dead things, he's like, just leave his body. Who cares? That's what I've learned about D'Artois. Once they're dead, I don't,
He's just kind of a jerk. At no point did I think he's cool in the story. He's just a jerk the whole time.
Well, it was cool that he had that sword cane.
We cut ahead to morning. Yvonne has recovered from the drugs. Barrett's wounds have been tended to, but he still has some questions for D'Artois. Why did Don Jose do all this? And this was your question. What was his end game? D'Artois explains that Don Jose was following the tradition of the Black Brotherhood and that his quest was for power.
Power.
Just power. There you go. So Yvonne asks, why did Sadie die? And finally, D'Artois doesn't actually know something. He says... Well, my best guess is that he was only a Kila and not a full initiate, and that he took on more power than he could handle. But he knew he was doing that, and his sacrifice was necessary to win the day, basically what I just said. D'Artois goes on to say that all the business about his other lives is part of the Order's beliefs, that they are all about reincarnation, that he thinks in a past life he failed at his task, and that he was able to rectify it in this new life. When Don Jose called on the elemental fire, that alerted Sadie to the presence of his age-old enemy, this enemy of all mankind. So they owe their life to Sadie, and we end with this.
I am an old man, he said, and vengeance leaves me weary. Let me, therefore, leave you in good hands while I rout out Monsieur le Préfet. I will have him dynamite the entrance of that accursed vault, so that no matter how ominous the stars may be, there will be no more archaic survivals coming forth in search of victims. And Barrett, regarding Yvonne Marigny, knew that when grief had received its due, untroubled moonlight on the Lachepaye wall would make the gray sphinx of the Pyrenees more alluring than before.
Well, it had a big explosion, and at least hinted at in the end.
Yeah.
Which I always like. You know, when there's, you just do some physical way to retaliate against the occult forces. He's kind of like, we're just going to blow it up so this doesn't happen again.
I like that kind of stuff, too. I like the just sort of getting in and getting dirty physicalness of it. But you and I were talking about how it's not a great story.
Or really a story at all, other than a series of events happen. You know, Andrew was right to recommend it because it does have all of the elements that we typically like. And, and obviously this guy was, he knew, you know, he actually met all of these great weird writers in person and he's part of the circle and I want to know more about him. But we've been doing a few interviews for Pitch Black Manor lately and talking about this. And I think this discussion about songs also applies to stories. And so in some of those discussions, I was saying that industrial or gothic or those kinds of things are really just production and arrangement styles. And that songs are written in all types of styles. Genre is generally referring to the package that a song comes in. And we know this because if a song's good, you can cover it in any genre and it's still good.
Yeah.
And a lot of songs become popular actually when other artists change the production and the arrangement.
Yeah.
And I think that that applies to short stories as well, where there are trappings and then there's story, and a good story can, you know, there's always a good story buried beneath those trappings. Sometimes when you just have the trappings, it's kind of unsatisfying. Mm. And when I'll criticize something, I usually am going after where's the story? And we can get to what that means in a second. But I also don't want to demonize things that are just the trappings, because sometimes I like that. Like I gave an example when we were talking before the show, like Godzilla movies. You know, I'm not as big a fan as I make out, because the actual movies themselves, I don't really watch much. I like putting them on because I like the people in the costumes fighting.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that. I really don't want it to be too involving, you know, because if it is, then that changes the way that I currently appreciate it. And there's certain kinds of horror slasher movies and things like this that I do like that are like that. And definitely when there was a paucity of Lovecraftian stuff around, I would have liked anything that had some cults and some ancient bad guys and some flying demons. It probably didn't need to have story. And even now, occasionally I'll pick something up that has those trappings because it's kind of comforting. Mm-hmm. But because we do read so much of this now, I think I get a little more sense of, like, where's the story?
Where's the conflict? The conflict that's interesting. Obviously, fighting a demon is a conflict, but it has to be more than, am I going to win this fight or lose this fight? What are the stakes of it? What are the stakes of the whole story? If this character dies, what does that mean? Or if they're victorious, what does that mean? Why is that interesting either way? And this story, it's like, well, if Barrett died, who cares? I'm not invested in any of this stuff. So the conflict doesn't really matter to me.
And the sort of powers didn't make sense.
No.
I didn't know how powerful anybody was or what they really could do or I don't know. And I find that a problem in, say, like modern superhero movies. You kind of get made fun of for being nerdy if you want to know what all of a character's powers are. But it's because you need to know that so you can understand the conflict.
Yeah.
You know, like that first Wonder Woman movie was wildly inconsistent in what Wonder Woman could do. And so it left me going, well, there's no stakes in this last fight. Maybe she'll just suddenly be able to lift 300 tons. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's the way it's been going so far. Yeah. And similarly, it didn't seem like there was any conflict these guys couldn't draw a circle to get out of. Mm-hmm. It's boring. Who cares?
Yeah.
And what did the antagonist even really want?
With conflict, it's all about the stakes. What is going to happen if they win? What happens if they lose? That's what's important. Mm-hmm. And look at any of the movies that you see or the ones that you really like. It's because if this hero wins this fight, it doesn't mean they win everything. You know, it's like if I beat this guy, yeah, I'll save my girlfriend, but then what's going to happen to my grandmother who I'm neglecting or who, you know, like all these very complicated aspects of a good conflict make it interesting because there's going to be consequences, usually some bad side to everything and obviously some good that will come of it. There could be conflicts where there's a bad outcome that's really bad and there's another slightly better outcome, but then how they deal with that fallout, that's when things get really interesting. And this story doesn't do any of that.
Yeah, and even, you know, that what's interesting is you're talking about some next level stuff, too. I mean, things get really good when there are stakes and choices to be made and all the choices are bad in one way or another.
You
know, you can really see that, you know, because that mirrors what we go through in life so much. And then also, those are outcomes that ratchet up your feelings of wanting to know how things are going to turn out. But what gets you through the conversation conflict too is the fact that the conflict's probably something that you're dealing with in your own life, have dealt with, or are preoccupied with to some extent, which is why a simple survival conflict, well, we're all dying and being threatened by the outside world, so that's very relatable. Mm-hmm. But also in a lot of stories, you'll find atonement with parental figures, people trying to deal with sins of the past. These are things that really fit into, say, A Shadow of Rinsmith, which is entirely gripping because there's like an element of shame in there that has to do with family and what you may really be. And then on top of that, you have an amazing conflict where it's just take all of the mythos out of it. And it's a guy trapped in a town with a group of bad guys who are trying to get him. Reskin it as a zombie movie. You know, that conflict is amazing. Everybody in this town, even the police are against me. So all of that stuff is really universal. Even despite the outcomes, you need all of those things, because at the end of the day, I think that people every day are trying to be listened to and be heard and to relate to other folks. And it's hard to get that from other people because they're all also going through it. And one function that literature occupies for us is that it's there for you.
Yeah.
You open it up and you plug in and you go, somebody else is struggling. There's vampires and stuff, but this is essentially, I'm worried about someone stealing my girlfriend and this vampire is trying to do that. And Dracula, you know, so it's like, I can relate to these kinds of things. And the book is listening. I mean, it's just sharing an experience in a way, and I don't have to, I don't know, I can click in with that and feel more connected. And so sometimes you just don't feel, that's the thing that you're missing. Now, that said, I don't want to demonize things that have all of the comforting things and then don't have a lot of substance to them, because sometimes I don't want to feel anything. You know, I'm having a bad day. I don't want to get involved in some kind of conflict that makes me feel bad or something. I was watching A Quiet Place Part 2 just last night, and the stuff that was happening to that family was terrible. I was like, no, turn it off. I don't want it. It's probably very good, but I'm just bumming me out. Let me watch the Godzilla movie. Let me see a guy in a suit punch another guy in a suit. That's funny. You know, so this kind of stuff is good too. I don't want to go full ham on it.
I want to thank Andrew Lieben for reading and for picking out the story. I know it wasn't, I mean, I still, there's lots of little gems in this story that I really did enjoy. Overall, it left me a little flat, but still. Guys fighting demons, wrestling demons with Japanese moves.
I agree. I laughed a lot during this, whether that was intentional or not, too. I mean, it just had that kind of fun silliness that I like, in Clark Ashton Smith, and I liked it here. Kind of a pro wrestling story in a way, and I like that.
And don't forget to go to the HPLHS website. Dark Adventure Radio Theater's production of The Horror in the Museum is out now. 77 minutes of amazingness. You must get it. Physically is the better way because it's got all the awesome props. But if you don't want the physical stuff, just get the audio. You'll be glad you did.
And there's a version that's just props, no story. No, that's not true. I want to thank some patrons for supporting us. And I'm going to start by thanking Lee Lyons.
I'd like to thank Robert Conway.
Louis Davies, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Scott Kennedy.
I'd like to thank Eric Hone.
Catherine M., thank you.
Derek Smike, thank you so much.
Hey, Darth Pseudonym, thank you.
Martha Lupton, thank you.
And lastly, Carlos McReynolds, thank you so much. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories
at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.